From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Well, it's Easter weekend. We're also in the Jewish season of Passover. Whatever your personal observance happens to be, I hope that you are able to spend time with the people who are most precious to you, renewing and recharging and refocusing on what is most important in life at a time when there are so many and such noisy distractions coming at us each and every day. As for us, we would ordinarily be offering you a best of show, as so many programs are doing this weekend, but we've simply got too much to share with you, and so this holiday weekend, please stay tuned for a brand new episode of State of Belief Radio. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, it's been pretty stormy in the USA this week. And by that I mean the seemingly endless coverage of an alleged affair between Donald Trump and adult film star Stormy Daniels. Are we still shocked to learn that while more white evangelicals actually believe Daniels than Trump, it still doesn't matter? Their support for this president is unshakable. It's at the level of religious fervor, one could say. Indeed, if I didn't know better, I might go so far as to suggest that the most gullible, unthinking, and malleable people are who comprise today's political religious right. But I suppose saying that would be unchristian. I pointed out last week the alarming combination of Islamophobia and a Christianist view of American exceptionalism pervading the policy positions of Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of State. Well, this week, we get to worry about John Bolton, who was expressed many of the same misguided convictions heading for the National Security Advisor office with no Senate confirmation needed. Meanwhile, the administration says the 2020 U.S. Census will ask respondents about their citizenship. Now, that's despite experts loudly warning of how this will undermine the accuracy of the constitutionally mandated count, not of citizens, but explicitly of residents. Now, thankfully, hundreds of lawsuits are already in the works to challenge this clearly deliberate undermining of our ability to understand who we are and what American is, never mind the allocation of resources and electoral votes, among other things. And the political religious right is livid about what it thinks is an omnibus spending bill funding Planned Parenthood signed by Donald Trump last week. Now, that's not hyperbole. Mike Huckabee sent around a fundraising email with the subject line, "I'm livid." While it is true that the bill failed to specifically target and defund critical healthcare millions of low-income Americans received from Planned Parenthood, it's likely Mike is actually livid over an even bigger religious right dream provision failing to survive, at least for now. They were hoping to make any health insurance policy that covers pregnancy termination ineligible for Obamacare reimbursements. For all of our sake, let's hope Mike continues to be livid for a long, long time. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
He does forgive us. That's what the cross is all about, what the resurrection's all about. That's the gospel. And you can get off on all kinds of different side trails. And in my earlier ministry, I did the same. But as I got older, I guess I became more mellow and more forgiving and more loving.
It's been over a month now since the passing at age 99 of the Reverend Billy Graham. At that time, I said some kind words here on our program. A lot of people who were definitely not fans of the late founder of the Billy Graham Evangelistic Crusade, at least, expressed a recognition that Graham represented a more restrained and less overtly political strain of conservative Christianity than many of his descendants, literal and figurative. A harsher and more personal rumination about Graham's impact on certain lives in this country appeared that week in the pages of Rolling Stone magazine, and I'm looking forward to speaking with journalist Bob Moser on this week's show.
I move from gratitude as a feeling to the radical practice of gratitude as the thing we most need right now to take down the oppressive structure of politics.
It's a widely recognized principle. Gratitude makes life better and challenges easier to endure. Religious and secular teachings alike have long promoted this idea, and now one of the most articulate writers of our generation weighs in with a book on this universal value. Dr. Diana Butler Bass has just published Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks, and I'm thankful that she'll be with us on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
you are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
Wednesday, April 4th, will mark the 50th anniversary of the brutal assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. So much has happened in the half century since that tragic moment in Memphis. The nation is unrecognizable in many ways, yet some of the biggest injustices Dr. King fought against continue to fester. The first anniversary of the Civil Rights Hero's murder was marked by an interfaith justice seder, and this year we'll see that commemoration reprised. Joining me right now is Stuart Applebaum, president of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union, who is also the president of the Jewish Labor Committee. Stuart, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Delighted to be with you today, and thank you for talking about the Seder that will be taking place in Memphis, Tennessee on April 4th.
The centrality of economic and labor justice to Dr. King's ministry activism has been lost for a lot of people, sadly. Would you briefly remind us of that important relationship?
I believe that the Seder gives us an opportunity to recommit ourselves to the values of Dr. King. We had values that our society should be inclusive, and that meant that everyone should be treated fairly in society with economic justice as well as inclusion. I believe that we have a problem in this country which is relating to deficits, but the deficit that is important is the solidarity deficit in this country, that people have forgotten that what is important in life are the ties that bind us to each other. we see that the Seder is really an opportunity to talk about that, to talk about our values, and to remind each other that Dr. King's message was a broad message that crossed all faiths, that it crossed all peoples. And that was a message that meant that everyone deserved to be treated with justice and dignity. That's important in every aspect of our lives. But as Dr. King would remind us, it was one thing to achieve the opportunity to sit at a lunch counter, but if you couldn't afford to buy anything, then justice had not been achieved.
Stuart, what were the origins of the Interfaith Seder all of those years ago?
Well, it's if you look at Dr. King's words, you find a real connection to the imagery of Passover. Passover was about freedom. Passover was about making the journey to the promised land. Dr. King's famous mountaintop speech comes from the imagery, the symbolism of the Exodus. And Dr. King was very close to the Jewish community as well. The Jewish community marched with Dr. King. The Jewish community 50 years ago was a strong, strong ally in the civil rights movement. Dr. King himself was scheduled to go to a Passover Seder 2 weeks after he was assassinated. Dr. King had open arms that included everyone. And it seemed that his message was the message of Passover. And this year, April 4th, falls in the middle of the Passover holiday. So it seemed to make sense that we should have a commemoration in Memphis. And we're doing it at the historic Claiborne Temple, where much of the planning by Dr. King and others for the sanitation worker strike took place. We have to remember always why it was that Dr. King was in Memphis that day. Dr. King was supporting the members of AFSCME who were sanitation workers and were on strike in Memphis and were demanding justice. His presence in Memphis when he was assassinated was about economic justice as well as civil rights. It was about labor rights. It was in support of labor unions. So this Seder is going to try to reflect on all of that. It is an interfaith Seder with civil rights leaders, with leaders from many religions, members of the Jewish Labor Committee, which is sponsoring the Seder. And we're very, very excited. We think it is an important moment where we renew the ties between different communities and the message of Dr. King and the civil rights movement. And we particularly want to renew the ties between the Jewish community and the civil rights movement.
What do you think is a really significant kind of remembrance as you connect that event 50 years ago with the Seder now? What did you hope people think about and realize through this commemoration?
One, that it is a recommitment to the values of the civil rights movement, but two, that it inspires us for the work that needs to be done going forward with every community. in every part of the country. So, for instance, it's farm workers throughout this country are not treated the way workers should be treated. People struggling throughout this country are trying to find a way to survive. I think that the Seder itself has to tell us that there is so much more work that continues to need to be done. And it will help us find the inspiration to keep moving forward. Mm. You can't see it now, but I just pulled out my phone because I'm going to a quote. I want to read it to you because it inspires me. It's about another from another great civil rights leader, A. Philip Randolph.
Hmm.
And A. Philip Randolph said, "Justice is never given, it is exacted. And the struggle must be continuous, for freedom is never a final fact, but a continuing battle." And that, I know, is what inspires me. And what inspires me as well was A. Philip Randolph was both a civil rights leader and a labor leader. He was the president of his union. And I think for many of us, we see the work we do as interchangeable.
Stuart, how can our listeners learn more about the Interfaith Seder April the 4th?
Go to the webpage of the Jewish Labor Committee, jewishlabor.org.
Stuart Applebaum is president of the Retail, Wholesale, and Department Store Union. He also heads the venerable 84-year-old Jewish Labor Committee. Stuart, I really appreciate what you're doing on this important anniversary, and I really appreciate you taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much. Thank you for what you do every day, and thank you for telling your listeners about the Labor Seder.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Writer Bob Moser, who penned the deeply personal Rolling Stone article, "The Soul-Crushing Legacy of Billy Graham," will be with us. And later I'll talk with Diana Butler Bass about her new book, "Grateful: The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks." I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. When the Reverend Billy Graham died this past February at the age of 99, many remembered him as representing a somehow kinder, gentler American evangelicalism. At the same time, his undeniable role in shaping much of American civil religion means that there were those who genuinely suffered because of his message. In Rolling Stone magazine, writer Bob Moser described the dark side of the power we gave to this one man as a society and as a culture. And I am pleased to welcome him to State of Belief Radio. Bob, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you so much.
The Soul-Crushing Legacy of Billy Graham. That's the headline. So, Bob, let's start there.
Yes, well, the headline is basically about the fact that Billy Graham did a lot of good for a lot of people. And I hoped to be one of those people myself when I was very young and was growing up knowing that I was gay, and went to a Billy Graham crusade in Raleigh, North Carolina in 1973, and was saved. However, nothing changed, which I think is a pretty common response to to that kind of salvation. At a football stadium. But a few months later, Graham had a column called "My Answer." It was syndicated in every newspaper in the country, pretty much. And he answered the question from a young woman who was a lesbian. And basically condemned gay people. The headline of that piece was "Homosexual Perversion, a Sin That's Never Right." And this was a huge thing for a lot of people, mm-hmm. because Billy Graham, as you say, was such a hugely influential figure, mm-hmm. And made himself into a figure that, you know, wasn't associated with that kind of hatefulness, mm-hmm. and that kind of hateful rhetoric. So when he said that, it felt like the voice of God passing judgment on people like me.
Yeah. Bob, the Rolling Stone article tells a searingly personal story. You basically describe how 20 years of your life were painfully, even suicidally, spent reacting to Graham's condemnation of LGBT persons. Talk about that, if you will.
Yes, I think this is unfortunately, this is a pretty common thing for a lot of gay and lesbian kids. But mm-hmm. I was growing up in the 1970s in a conservative Christian family in North Carolina, and it was. I had a struggle for the rest of my until I was 30 years old. I mm-hmm. finally came to grips with the fact that God had made me the way that God made me, mm-hmm. but it took 2 decades of real struggle to get there and to get that the voice of Billy Graham out of my head in a certain way.
Mm-hmm. Bob, I have one of my very best friends who is a lesbian, who is a public person. And after Graham's death, she wrote a very honest piece telling what her feelings were and how her life was actually made more difficult by some of the things that he wrote and some of the things that he said. And she got a really terrible feedback on that, with people criticizing her and saying, how could you do this? What kind of reaction have you gotten from your writing?
I got much of the same kind of reaction, a very horrified reaction. First of all, you're speaking ill of the dead, and that's mm-hmm. a cultural no-no. But people really, Billy Graham built an image for himself, and it was incredibly successful. And it's remarkable how it lasted, mm-hmm. Even beyond his son Franklin being a much more intolerant and openly intolerant in some ways figure. But Billy Graham continued to have this reputation, which made it, you know, just even more difficult for people. Mm-hmm. But the reaction I got was, it was either very strong condemnation or it was a lot of, I got a lot of gratitude as well, mm-hmm. From a lot of people who had similar experiences or had similar experiences, at least with Christianity and evangelical Christianity.
Yeah. Let's go all the way back to that night in that stadium. You were happy to go to that crusade for Christ in the hope of finding a way out. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I grew up as a churchgoer, but I knew that Reverend Graham promised a kind of salvation that didn't seem to come from the church. Mm-hmm. And, and you watched it on television, and the Crusades were, you know, incredibly popular television in the 60s and 70s. And you saw people being saved, and you felt that you were somehow joining this community, mm-hmm. With Billy Graham as the sort of gentle patriarch of it. And I did. And I kept in touch with the Billy Graham Association for many years, and received mailings and took things very much to heart, mm-hmm. and, you know, did not understand until later that, you know, so much of so much of the teaching was not particularly particularly sound theology, mm-hmm. let's say.
Well, during those early years, were there any influences in your life that counterbalanced the message Graham and the church were delivering? Was anybody saying to you, it's okay to be gay?
No. No. And I don't believe that I heard that until probably until I was in my late teens. Probably not until I went to college. And yeah, I think I'd never heard that, though. Homosexuality wasn't spoken of much at the time, because the lesbian gay rights movement had just really begun at that point. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, you know, in my family and in the kind of world I grew up in, and most people did at the time, it just was a thing you didn't mention. It was really the sin too horrible to mention.
Well, obviously you were hurt by these experiences. The fact is, it's hard to even read some of your words in that article. The idea of a young man fighting to quote unquote reform or face eternal damnation. That's a heavy thing. Bob, you still feel the pain of all of this on some level even today?
Yes, I would say that doesn't go away. And, you know, I certainly felt that pain again when I was writing the story.
Sure.
Very difficult thing to write about and to go back to. You know, but I think it's important in part because, you know, the truth about Billy Graham is important. He was such a huge figure, and the truth about him is very complex.
Yeah.
But the legacy for a lot of people like me was really damaging, and it doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I struggle very much to, you know, embrace religion, even though I still feel that it's very important and central in life. But organized religion to me was a force of repression, and so it sticks with you in a very, very deep way for a very long time, forever, I think.
Do you describe yourself by any religious affiliation now?
I still think of myself as a Christian, in some ways as, I guess, a red-letter Christian.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never believed that, you know, I was able to continue to believe in Jesus,
mm-hmm.
And in Jesus's words and actions and, mm-hmm. and example.
Yeah.
But the rest of it, the rest of it to me is something that didn't, you know, that promised salvation from the person that God made me.
Yeah.
And that's a, so I think it's very difficult. I think it's difficult for a lot of people.
Yeah.
When they've had that experience.
Wonderful organizations like Faith in America and others use terms like spiritual abuse and challenge the way LGBT people are routinely condemned in certain denominations. And I think it's so important to label this misguided hate for what it is. Do you think the resources are out there today that would have helped you all of those years ago?
You know, I do think they are. I do think they are. And makes me very happy to say that. But I think it would be very difficult for someone to be as isolated as I was and as many kids were and not to have that other perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's extremely important because, you know, I think that, you know, kids are going to get it now online. They're going to find out just about everything online. And you know, most of the messages that they're going to see online about Christianity and homosexuality are going to be negative, but they're not all going to be negative.
Right.
And I do think that some of those organizations have done a great job, and in a way, it's a you know, it's a sort of counter propaganda campaign to make sure that kids aren't isolated and left in that place.
You know, we also have some politicians formerly endorsing so-called reparative therapy, and it's always in some religious context. What are your thoughts on that still being a thing in 2018?
It's astonishing. It's really astonishing. The damage that's been done by reparative therapy is very well documented. And it's completely discredited, but except, as you say, and by certain Christian organizations. And I think it's particularly horrifying, and I'm really glad, you know, that for all the trauma that I went through, at least I did not have to go through that. I did not go to conversion therapy, and I think that would have been damaging enough that I may have ended up killing myself. I know a lot of people who did go through that. And, you know, this is it's an even more aggressive way of teaching people that they are evil and that the love that they feel is evil.
Bob, say there's a young man or woman who has grown up in a similar environment as you did and who's suffering to some extent the same way you did. What would you say to that young gay person of faith?
Oh, I would have a lot of things to say, but I think that the first thing I would say is pay attention. You know what Jesus said. You know what Jesus did. You know who Jesus was. And if you don't, start to take another look. But I think I would tell them that there is hope, and that this is not what the world thinks of you.
Bob Bozer is senior editor at National Journal and author of Blue Dixie, Awakening the South's Democratic Majority. He's the former editor of the Texas Observer, senior editor-writer at The Nation, and executive editor of The American Prospect. Bob's deeply personal Rolling Stone article is headlined "The Soul-Crushing Legacy of Billy Graham," and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Bob, I'm really grateful for you being willing to come on and talk with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, Wilton, thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure.
A new book from independent scholar and speaker Dr. Diana Butler Bass, titled Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks. And I am so pleased that this brings her back to State of Belief Radio. Diana, thanks for being with us again.
Well, I'm really excited to be here and talk about the new book.
What made you want to write about gratitude this time?
Well, it was twofold. One, my last book was called Grounded, and it was really a theology for the world. So what I was trying to do was not write a theology for the church, but I was trying to write a theology for people who might be still in churches or people who had left churches, people who are spiritual but not religious, and get them to think about how God was present in the world of nature and the world of neighbor. But after I wrote the book, I kept thinking, well, what does this matter? You know, if you write a theology book and it has no practices that people can really do in their own lives associated with it, it kind of falls on deaf ears in a way. And so I was thinking, what kinds of spiritual practices truly embody a newer experience of finding God in the world with us? What kind of spiritual practices do we need to lift up and are significant at this moment in our life together? So I was ruminating on that question. And then I was also ruminating on the fact that I was in my late 50s. I just turned 59, actually, which is a great year to turn, because you're thinking about the future and you're thinking about the kind of person you want to be in the coming decades of your life. And I realized that I knew a lot of people my age and a little bit older who spent most of their time thinking about what had not happened in their lives and being kind of resentful about that. And then I knew people who were older than myself who were able to see their own lives and live in a sense of deep gratitude, and I realized I wanted to be more like the latter instead of the former. So that's really it. I was thinking about the practical implications of some theology I had written, and I was thinking about my own life and how do I really live gratefully, and what would that look like?
I'm really glad that you did the lessons that you share in the book. I'm curious how much of these lessons comes from organized religion and how much from science or somewhere else.
My writing now is geared towards what I would call faith in the world. And part of that is just for the simple fact that so many people are leaving conventional or institutional religion behind. And I have concerns about that, not because, you know, I ultimately am worried about the survival of religious institutions. But what I am concerned about is that religious institutions were born in order to forward particular truths about the universe, to embody the wisdom of their founders, and to teach people spiritual practices. So the more that religious institutions are under threat, and that people just don't care any longer, or people are angry at them, or people just don't find them meaningful anymore, I'm less concerned about the loss of the institution than I am about the loss of the wisdom. And so the work that I've been doing recently is putting the wisdom sort of outside the walls of institution. You know, I am a Christian. I still do go to church. My husband works at a church. But at the same time, I want people to keep connecting with the deep wisdom of Christianity, with the deep wisdom of the scriptures, and with the deep wisdom of the spiritual practices, which have framed up Christianity over time. But now we're doing it in a different location. So gratitude becomes part of that. And in grateful, I take some things that are really important, essential pieces of wisdom and beautiful stories from my own life, but also from scripture and also from the history of Christianity. And I apply those differently and try to open them up to people who no longer go to church.
Dinah, I want to ask you how these lessons look in practice. Is there a methodical way to engage Thanksgiving in our daily lives?
In some ways, Grateful is one of the most highly, I think, organized books I've ever written, because it really walks through four aspects of gratitude. And those four aspects are along an axis of feelings to action. So if people who are listening to us can imagine an axis of feeling and action, and then a second axis of the personal and the public realm, how our lives are about us as individuals and how our lives are in community. And so the book moves through these four quadrants, which I call me and my emotions related to gratitude, and me and my practices or my ethic of gratitude, and then to me, we and our feelings as communal expressions of gratefulness, and then we and our actions as far as our political and social embodiment of gratitude. And so there are 8 chapters, 2 on each one of those things. And what I dream is when readers look at this and read all the way through the book, hopefully they read all 8 chapters and mm-hmm. not just 2 of them mm-hmm. or half of the book. But they'll see that these 2 dimensions of our lives as individuals, there's work to be done to move from the random sort of ad hoc feelings of, oh my, you know, surprise and wonder and humility and relief and all the beautiful things that we feel when we feel gratitude, to a more sustained practice and a personal ethic of gratitude. Mm-hmm. That is, how do we share gratitude with others? How do we give gifts and how do we receive gifts and acknowledge gifts in ways that are meaningful to the world around us? And then the second piece is, how do we, in communal settings, feel those same senses of wonder, surprise, joy that are associated with gratitude as groups? And then how do we take that and translate it into a more sustained way of life? And what I knew you would love about the book, probably more than almost anyone who will interview me, is that I end up suggesting that what is really needed right now is a politics of gratitude.
Well, I do want you to talk about that, because, as you know, there are a lot of people who are sad and a lot of people who are scared, and both of those emotions can almost overcome gratitude. So talk about that.
The contract was signed to write this book in the spring of 2016. And so here I am, doing research, thinking about gratitude, exploring some new practices, because I like, my books are always very authentic out of what I'm going through and what my practices are. And the election is happening. Yeah. And I'm looking at the television, and I'm getting increasingly alarmed by what I'm seeing, like most Americans were. And the visible anger and the racism, and I had already been disturbed about what was going on with the violence directed towards particularly young black men in cities, and I had been supportive of much of Black Lives Matter, and I'm just looking at all this, and I'm thinking to myself, what is going on? This is horrible.
Yeah.
And so I have a contract to write a book on gratitude. And I kept thinking all through the spring and the summer and the early fall, in 2016, okay, I can do this research now, and I can just try out some of these gratitude practices, but I can't do this until I feel more grateful. So this is just going to have to wait until after the election. And so I literally took the project, and I emotionally set it aside until I could face feeling more grateful after the election, because I assumed, you know, that Hillary Clinton was going to win and that this anger was going to ebb and that we'd all go back to normal. And then we had the election. And I couldn't even, on November 9th, I could not even get out of bed. I remember waking up that morning and I thought that I had had a nightmare. And I asked my husband, I said, is it true? And he looked at me and he said, it's true. And I just started sobbing. And I went through about 6 weeks of that. And I called my publisher and I said, should I write a different book? What could gratefulness possibly have to do about all this? And they said, well, you're under contract. And so I got back to the book about 3 days before the inauguration. And I remember when I finally went back to writing it, I woke up that morning and I said, okay, thank God, Obama is president for 3 more days. So that was my thanks that day. And I went to my office and I started writing. And I spent the first 100 days of Donald Trump being president of the United States writing a book on gratitude.
How did you come to a moment of peace to give yourself to what you were writing about?
I literally was responsible for a contract, and I take those obligations very seriously. And so I thought, well, I better do this. And I would wake up in the morning, and I'd watch Morning Joe, or I'd read Twitter or the Washington Post. I live in the suburbs of D.C. And I would be feeling the same anxiety that everybody else is feeling. But then I would say, okay, what's the one thing I'm grateful for? And I would come up with something, you know, the sun came up today. Or my favorite one, there was some point along the way where I remember for a whole week I said, no one has launched a nuclear weapon yet, you know, and so that was my gratitude, and we're still here. And so what I really started doing was just looking for, in the middle of all of this horrible stuff and these painful feelings of depression that I had, I started trying to find the places of something different,
mm-hmm.
goodness, kindness, grace, where God was showing up, where love was appearing. And there was always something. The more I looked for things to be grateful for,
mm-hmm.
the more things showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And as that process unfolded in my own soul, I began to see really interesting things about the political nature of gratitude. And the book became entirely different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that had the election turned out in the other direction, I would have written just one more gratitude book by a privileged white lady.
Mm-hmm.
But what it became was this deep kind of searching journey book into when things don't go very well and the role of suffering and how gratitude plays itself out in our political and communal lives. And I learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And as that learning unfolded, it began to give me a sense of real power and resilience and an ability to be able to not be completely colonized by the news and by the real sheer narrative force of Donald Trump, who has entered into our consciousnesses and colonized us all. And so I was able to free myself from that through these practices of gratitude, which was quite extraordinary.
Diana, you wrote a book on gratitude out of struggle. And that's how most of us will experience gratitude. And you have proven your authority for writing something that all of us need to pay attention to.
Well, for me, the authority of the power of the subject emerged as transformative.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember what the original subtitle of this book was. But people say that gratitude changes things.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought of that as kind of a secular prosperity gospel, you know, a little self-helpy, maybe kind of New Age religion. And yet, my exact experience was living through that 100 days and writing a book about gratitude,
mm-hmm.
which I, like I said, I had originally conceived of as a book about spiritual practice in the world, something I could write, because I'm not a gratitude expert. I'm an expert on spirituality and religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to take gratitude and run it through the frame of shifting trends around religion and spirituality. That was the first sort of vision of the book.
Mm-hmm.
But then the vision of the book changed because everything around us changed. And I went into that moment and I had to find my own sense of empowerment. I had to find where I thought that the spirit was truly present at this difficult time in American history. And that's what comes through in the pages. And it changed me. And I tell my friends that I've written a book that appears to be a self-help book, but it's actually a radical political theology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's only disguised as a self-help book.
So
what I hope will happen is people who care about their own, you know, their own well-being,
mm-hmm.
who do actually care about gratitude as a practice of spirituality and self-help,
right.
will pick this book up, and then they'll find that it is so much more.
Mm, you're right.
It's not just self-help, but it might be political help.
Dr. Diana Butler Bass is an author, speaker, and independent scholar specializing in American religion and culture. She is a very honest person. Her books show the honesty. That's why she is so relevant. Her many important books include Grounded, Finding God in the World and Christianity After Religion. Her latest is titled Grateful, The Transformative Power of Giving Thanks. Diana, it's always great to have time to talk with you. I want to make sure our listeners know that you somehow found the time also to narrate the audiobook version of Grateful. So that's another way for them to spend some time with you and your ideas. As always, thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
I'm very grateful for you, Wilson, and our friendship, and keep up all the good work you do in the world. It makes a difference.
You too. Now, before we go, last weekend it was breathtaking and heartbreaking to hear the testimonies of the young survivors of Parkland, Florida, and so many other gun tragedies across the country at the marches nationwide. The raw honesty, the brutal eloquence, the articulate rage that for once mainstream media amplified without reservation or faltering, all of it left me feeling as hopeful as I have felt in a very long time. And I cannot stress enough how critically important it is that these young people are speaking not only for themselves, but for the victims of senseless gun violence who never make the headlines nor garner national attention. As hope-giving as this movement has been, it has been equally encouraging to see how impotent the extremist leadership of the NRA and its enablers in the far-right media truly are in the face of fearless truth. Whether it's theocratic Rick Santorum's convoluted call for students to learn CPR and condemning their patriotic engagement in our democratic system as some sort of abdication of personal responsibility, or pathetic attempts to create amateurish memes of student activists tearing up the Constitution or even replacing the audio of a speech with a historical recording of Adolf Hitler. America is very quickly and at long last seeing how powerless is the rhetorical man behind the curtain of NRA leadership, even as investigations start of Russian campaign contributions having been illegally laundered through the group. A vast majority of NRA members recognizes the eminently reasonable arguments being made by the students and are becoming increasingly alienated from the extremist NRA leaders that purport to represent them and their interests. What I see coming next is a generation of young people with values that you and I are likely to feel great affinity for, discovering their power and potential far beyond the issues of gun and school safety. I see them defying the cynicism and indifferences and distractibility that so many of us thought defined this generation. But it doesn't. This weekend, Christians are observing Easter, celebrating the resurrection of Jesus and the most hope-giving day of the entire year. For Jews, this is the season of Passover, commemorating safe passage out of Egypt and the survival of Israel's firstborn children through the 10th plague. And in just a few days, Muslims observe one of the holiest days of the year with the Isra and Miraj, remembering the night journey of the prophet that was both physical and spiritual. With the Abrahamic religions focusing on themes of transition and survival, young men and young women in our country, many of them resolutely secular, are speaking out along the same themes. And you know what? I see that as a very, very good thing indeed. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We want you to engage in the discussion. Invite others to do the same. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.